BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my team of all-female detectives as we meet women from all walks of life who despise ordinary life and became extraordinary. They decide, by hook or by crook, to change their lives. In this episode, we'll shine a spotlight on four women from history who swindle for a living and end up making it big. Sophie Lyons, career criminal.
With my husband in prison, the support of my little ones fell wholly on my shoulders. I did not know it was wrong to steal. No one ever taught me that.
Anne-Marie Provis, art hoaxer.
A passion for drawing and painting prevailed over every other inclination, and Provis allowed her to indulge it.
Fanny Davies, an uncommon thief who dresses in male clothes.
She was soon after carried to the public office in Bow Street, where the notes were sworn to by Mr. Wigglesworth. Her boy's apparel was also produced. She denied any knowledge of the transaction with great composure.
Madam Rachel, beauty scammer.
Ladies, I pray, take example by me.
How frequently we find that a slight blemish on the face.
Can't forget Madam Rachel, no, never, though she got from me a very large fee. In return, I got beauty forever.
Our lady swindlers choose cons, hoaxes, and tricks. They dream of a better life. But ultimately, does crime pay? Let's find out. Just quickly before we dive in, the cases we're going to discuss are covered in previous episodes of this series of Lady Swindlers. So if you haven't already listened, there are spoilers ahead. Now, there's no one better to help me answer my questions than our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. Welcome, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
And our guest detective today is Baroness, applause please, Aisha Hazarika, MBE, broadcaster, journalist and comedian. Aisha, welcome back to our Lady Universe and congratulations on becoming a member of what should be called the House of Ladies, but for now we will call it the House of Lords.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. Rosalind, it's lovely to see you and it's so fantastic to be back in this wonderful coven.
You call us witches.
In a good way.
We'll take it. Now, Aisha, our lady swindlers this time have various jobs. We have a pickpocket who becomes what I might call a multi-genre con woman. She does it all. We have a thief, an uncommon thief. We have a beautician. Not all beauticians are hoaxers, but this one is. And we have an artist. If you were a swindler, what would be your speciality?
What a good question. Maybe I'd be a sort of confidence trickster because I've come from the world of politics and stand-up comedy. You've got to be quite confident and you've got to sort of gain people's trust.
I know that confidence is a key thing. I once stole an easel upon which the menu is displayed in a restaurant. There were good reasons why I did this. But I remember the secret was just absolute confidence. I walked in there, I didn't ask anyone, I just took it. That's confidence.
And I think that's like a great kind of skill in life when you're scamming people. I say this like I'm a scammer, like I know it really well. But a lot of it is kind of getting people to trust you.
Yes, yes. What about you, Ros?
I would be a seller of fake historical artefacts.
Oh, brilliant.
As a child, I spent a lot of time making replica medieval manuscripts. And I think it's kind of better to stick with what you know. So I think I'd move into the realm of Victorian artefacts. So fake Victorian artefacts and sell them as the real deal.
Have you seen those vampire slaying kits that you can buy in boxes and they look like they're proper Victorian things? But actually, they were all made in the 1970s in San Francisco.
Yep.
You know exactly what I mean.
Absolutely. I've done my homework. I'm set up and ready to go.
I love it.
Now, let's think about female-only spaces. We'd like to think of female-only spaces as inherently safe, and in many cases they are, but not when our lady swindler, Madam Rachel, is involved. Madam Rachel is a businesswoman who owns a booming beauty salon in fancy Mayfair in London in the 1860s. Her clients are middle and upper-class women, and she promises them eternal beauty.
Madam Rachel's success in restoring and beautifying the complexion, imparting a bewitching brilliancy to the eyes, removing all defects and adding fresh grace and luxuriance to the hair, has been acknowledged by the aristocracy of the country.
She's obviously a marketing genius. And when she gets dragged into the courtroom, she uses the publicity. In 1863, she builds on her notoriety with a 24-page marketing pamphlet called Beautiful Forever.
She said it was necessary I should be made beautiful forever so I could be married to the rich and good man she had introduced to me.
I think today we call Madam Rachel a beauty scammer. And she's unique amongst all of our swindlers as the only one specifically targeting women. She uses female insecurities to make money. Aisha, what are we supposed to make of this?
I have to say, I kind of love Madam Rachel. And I just know, back in the day, I would literally be her perfect victim. I would be like, get me, I need the hope in a jar. I want to be restored to full glory. I need fresh grace. And I think in a way, what she's doing is, as you say, she's preying on female insecurity. But I do feel that Madame Rachel is not an aberration. You look at literally every big beauty company today. You look at, gosh, look at female magazines. My generation growing up reading female magazines, you know, whether it was Cosmopolitan or whatever, you were just fed a diet of A, how to be really insecure about how you look and how to fix how you look. This is an eternal battle that women face. And that was women, you know, women editors, women journalists, women contributors, female celebrities. So while I think Madam Rachel's obviously done bad things, I think she's a metaphor for sort of women through the ages and the insecurity that's placed upon us by not just men, but other women as well.
When you go into the beauty salon, it's very often an all-female environment and you kind of relax. Aisha, what's it like going into the historically male-dominated House of Lords? Can you relax there?
It does feel like the space is inherently masculine. When you look around at the icons on the wall and the art and the statues, it's very much like thrusting men with swords, and it's very alpha and it's very, very masculine. And the portrayal of women, it's women almost like art on the wall or as nurturers or carers. But a building is more than just the architecture. A building is what's in it and who is in it as well. And I do feel gratified that certainly over my time in Parliament, there have been more women that have come in, and that has changed the atmosphere a lot. There are also more female journalists, so the kind of infrastructure around politics is changing as well. And I think all of that does help.
So I'm glad to hear that we think about politicians having an old boys' network. There's an old girls' network too now, is there?
I'd say a really good women's network across Parliament. And I think one of the things that is not known is that behind the tribalism that you see, a lot of really good women from all different political parties do come together to try and work behind the scenes. They're not exactly a women's caucus, but there is much more cross-party working that goes on. And also, there's more practical things that are happening. Back in the day, there used to be a shooting range in Parliament, but there was no childcare facilities. That is changing, thankfully. But I do feel that with the numbers of women going up, there's much more interest in talking about a wider range of issues. The economy should be something where nurseries are as important as nuclear. Infrastructure is childcare as well as roads and rail and things like that, and social care. So I think we are advancing. We've had three female prime ministers in British political history, and we now have a female chancellor.
Fabulous, fabulous. Now, Aisha, we already know, because you've told us, that you do want to be beautiful forever.
I've got hidden depths, honestly. I'm not this shallow.
What about you, Roz? I'd just be honest, I'd just settle for being beautiful now, forget forever.
You have internalised the male gaze. We don't agree, do we, Aisha?
The thoughts police are coming for you as feminists now.
Ros, how does Madame Rachel's ideal look fit into wiser Victorian ideals about beauty? It sounds to us quite strange what she did to people.
It does. Women at that time, they were under pressure to keep their youthful looks. And that was very hard to do in this period when cosmetics were still thought of as immoral, associated with prostitutes. And also, they were considered to be potentially fraudulent, that you were hiding your true self. And then the man would see the real you. It's a terrible thing to do to him. So Madame Rachel is offering treatments to preserve and also to restore good looks. We talked about the idea of enamelling in the episode, and Madame Rachel was very famous for this. And so we see here an emphasis really on whiteness, and we have the use of arsenic sometimes in cosmetics to achieve that kind of whiteness. But it's interesting because beauty was also associated with exotic places and the East. And so Madame Rachel had her children dressed in a kind of Arabian style to greet the customers. And she had Arabian baths.
Can I just say, I would love this salon. I'm actually going to set up a salon called Madame Rachel's. I just think, I'm sorry, this sounds amazing. I mean, apart from the arsenic bit, it does sound really good.
Well, we could join up and I could do the fake Victorian artefacts.
Yes, I could. This is my scam. This is my scam. But what's really interesting about what you said there about the whiteness, you know, I'm a woman of colour and from an Indian background. There's still so many similarities today. There's a terrible premium on paler skin. And certainly whenever I've been to India and you go to the beauty parlour, there are treatments to try and lighten your skin. Skin bleaching creams. So this issue of colourism is a real thing in terms of beauty standards.
It's so often the case, isn't it, that you think about the past as this strange barbaric place, and then you sometimes realise, actually, we do the same.
Yeah,
not
we're all trying to deal
so
with
much.
Our tash.
OK, now, Aisha, you are in the spotlight a lot. You live a public life, especially now that you're a peer. Can you tell us a bit about the challenges that come with that?
I think anybody in the public eye in this day and age is faced with a barrage of just constant abuse, particularly in a world which is very social media driven, where anybody can just send you a message and people feel like it's their God-given right, if they don't like something about you, just to like let you know immediately. I get lots of lovely messages as well, but it's a sad part of modern life.
The dark side of fame. Now, listen, if there's a woman who does enjoy the spotlight, it is our swindler, Sophie Lyons. She is all over the newspapers, Aisha, from 1872 to 1924 when she dies. And even after that, actually, a simple search will bring you thousands of articles. Here's some of them, actually. I've got the Fort Worth Gazette, 1895. There's a picture of her with a caption saying, Sophie Lyons, the queen of American criminals and the most expert pickpocket in the world. There she is. She looks good, doesn't she?
She does look good.
And then we have the Spokane Press, 1903. Here's an article. It's called A Crook and a Bit of Kindness. And in it, she's quoted. She says, I've been a bad woman, but I love my children. I tell you, I am through forever with the old ways. And that's because she turned her back on her life of crime by that point. In 1913, she releases her memoir, which is called Why Crime Does Not Pay. And when she dies in 1924, we have two pages about her in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Notorious woman crook. I love that. Notorious woman crook who turned straight and left honest fortune. What a legacy. Now, Sophie didn't get great buildings or libraries or town halls named after her like Carnegie or Rockefeller did. But I do see Sophie Lyons as living the American dream. I like to think of her as a robber baroness, whereas Rockefeller and the rest of them were known as the robber barons. Aisha, Sophie's narrative about herself then, a criminal forced into it by circumstances, who reforms and becomes a philanthropist, doesn't completely match what we know about her from other sources. Believe women are words that you hear a lot. Should we always believe what women say?
Of course, each case has to be looked at in its merits. When you look at women who come forward, particularly women who have been the victims of, let's say, violence or sexual assault, I do think we should have a culture where we believe women more because, again, time immemorial, we never believe women. And partly that's because of the power imbalance in society. We always want to sort of believe the more powerful person.
Roz, as a historian, how should we scrutinise women's narratives, women's words, but without silencing them?
We have to be critical. As historians, we very much read between the lines. If we think about Lyons, we think about her public transcript, which is her memoir. We might find a hidden transcript buried in there. We find thumbing her nose at authority. There's a look at what I got away with idea in the narrative.
You know how hard it is for a man or woman to secure permanent work after leaving prison? I am going to help some of these. They will find a friend in Sophie Lyons.
The reason why I think Sophie is such a fascinating character, because she doesn't just accumulate the money just to have a nice time. I'm not saying this kind of cleanses her of all her sins, but I think she's a very modern character. The fact that she has gone through this life of crime, she can see the downsides as well as obviously living off the profits. And I think her idea of reform and helping prisoners and offering people a bit of a lifeline when they come out of prison is actually a subject we're still grappling with today in terms of modern public policy.
I hear everything you say, but the reason I'm a bit cynical is that she monetizes her career choice to be a reformed criminal. I would have felt that if she was truly reformed, she'd just quietly get on with it.
But I think many people, particularly who have gone through the system like that, they do want to share their story. A lot of men do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite a well-worn track for like a...
Ex-politicians.
Correct. Just look at Lord Geoffrey Archer.
Maybe I'm judging her more harshly than I would do if she were male and I've fallen into that trap. Now, Sophie would like it if we talked about her until the end of the episode. So let's move on. It's much harder to get to know about swindlers like Fanny Davies, the thief, and Anne Mary Provis, the art hoaxer, because these are women from quite low down in society. We have no record of their own words. They don't get to write their own stories. So we have to go back and reconstruct their lives in other ways. And we can do that because there are plenty of sources about them. In 1785, the audacious thief, Fanny Davies, dresses as a boy and befriends a grazier that she meets in a pub called Mr. Wigglesworth. After earning his trust, she steals his trousers and with them the equivalent of £160,000 in today's money, that is. I love the fact that 100 years later, Sophie Lyons also steals a man's trousers. It appears to be a theme of our swindlers. Ross, what would the equivalent of £160,000 today have got you in 1785?
A one-way trip to Australia?
Well, that's what Fanny got, isn't it? Now, Fanny finds herself the centre of attention, not exactly for the theft, but for the wildly popular semi-fictional pamphlets about her, portraying her as a daredevil highwaywoman who wears men's clothes and also describing her as a promiscuous sex worker who seduces people and then dumps them. Well, do you think that Fanny Davies was actually interviewed by the people who wrote all of these pamphlets? Do they in any way represent her own story?
It's certainly possible. In those days, you could go into a prison just by giving the jailer a few coins. And particularly notorious criminals or criminals sentenced to death, they did attract these authors of pamphlets too. And those criminals, they might have been paid a bit of money. And having some money in prison then was quite useful.
But surely they played with the truth a little bit. They wouldn't reproduce what the criminal actually said if the criminal actually said anything.
Oh, of course. I think in the telling, it could work both ways. It could have been that if Fanny was interviewed, she embellished her own life and added a good bit of colour to it as well.
Highway woman.
That's right. Mm-mm. And I think we can safely say that the author was also drawing on popular stereotypes and writing to a template and thinking what his audience wanted.
I hadn't really thought that Fanny Davies may have invented the story of the highwaywoman thing herself, but you're saying that could have happened?
It could have happened.
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, onto our art hoaxer, Anne Mary Provis, a painter who in 1797 claims to have possession of the Venetian secret. Aisha, this is a long-lost and highly prized Renaissance painting technique, and she sells it to some of the most respected painters and members of the Royal Academy. With nerves of steel, she also demonstrates this technique to them. Now, after the hoax is exposed, songs about Anne Mary, there are many of them, depict her as a devious woman using sex to bamboozle these top artists. Aisha, in both of these cases, I think it's fair to say, it's assumed that these women only got on in life through their sexual attraction. The poor men involved were powerless to resist. Do you still see this going on today?
Definitely. It's a kind of a well-worn trope that particularly for younger women, that success must be predicated somehow on the exchange of sexual favours. But I thought what was so interesting about both of these cases was that they're very interesting women, they're very resilient women, but the lens that society back in the day, and society still today, we all have this lens that we put on, which is they have to be a sexy daredevil. There has to be a sexual element. When you see it written up in tabloid press, when you see how social media sometimes catches fire after a particular story involving a woman, there is always a sexual angle to it.
Now, Rods, in Lady Swindlers, we are keen on hearing women's words and voices. But what do we do when these voices are absent? And why is it important to tell those stories anyway?
Yeah, so often groups that are marginalised in history have been effectively silenced in the historic record. We get glimpses of their existence when they exert their agency, when they clash with the authorities in some way. And this applies not just to women, but also to Indigenous peoples, especially in a colonial context, and people of minority ethnicity, as well as LGBT people. And to ignore these groups simply because we cannot hear their voices is to produce, in my view, a distorted understanding of the past and to impoverish our understanding of our society today. So what do we do? I think over the years, historians have been really good at recovering the history of these marginalised people, reading from different public transcripts versus what we call hidden transcripts and reading between the lines. So we just keep on going. History is an evolving thing.
Ross is talking about how women's voices are sometimes missing in the past, but Aisha, today, even today, women's voices tend to get drowned out. Would you agree?
I think we are making strides. For example, just look at this brilliant show that we're on now. But I am still struck by how dominated a lot of our discourse is, a lot of our cultural narrative is by male voices, a very heteronormative male voice, a white, cultured, privileged male view of the world. We do hear more women's voices and we celebrate more women. But we celebrate a certain type of woman. We still very much treasure and put up on a pedestal, again, white, wealthy, beautiful women. Their stories are told a lot. To Rosalind's point, the stories and lives of women from different groups, and not just on racial lines, but different socioeconomic groups as well, I still feel like we've got a way to go with that.
Now, the British author Victoria Smith, in her book Hags, The Demonisation of Middle-Aged Women, says that the middle-aged lady is still an object. You've just changed in status from painting or sculpture to, say, hat stand. Aisha, is it better to be objectified as a beautiful painting or just as a functional hat stand? What do you think?
I'm not going to be bound into those two binaries. I do feel so strongly that older women should be allowed to age in the way that they want. Some older women will just want to grow gracefully and naturally. Other women will want to maybe cling on to the youth. I'm probably slightly more in that category. We have to sort of change our lens in terms of what we see as beautiful. Beautiful is not always svelte and wrinkle-free. Beautiful can be middle-aged, a bit thicker around the waist and wrinkles and all of that kind of thing.
Roz, what do you think? Are we all destined to become hat stands?
I think the hat stand idea is not a universal phenomenon, but we need to call it out when we see it, obviously. We can point to places in the world today, and we can also see past societies where postmenopausal women are or were considered of great value for their knowledge and wisdom. And I think this gives us hope. It doesn't have to be the way it is in this culture in Anglo-American culture today. We do not have to be hat stands. It can be different.
That's why I think we should study history, not to learn from the past, but to learn that it doesn't have to be the way that it is today. Now, there's no denying that for at least 3 out of the 4 lady swindlers we've been discussing, crime did pay. It does pay for career criminal turned philanthropist Sophie Lyons, who dies well off. It pays to a certain point for beauty scammer Madam Rachel. She does die in prison, unable to enjoy her fortune, though. I think that crime probably did pay for thief Fanny Davies, who cheated the gallows and created a new life for herself in Australia. Not an easy life, but life nonetheless. And finally, art hoaxer Anne Mary Provis. We don't know what happened to her after the hoax was exposed, but presumably she got enough money to live quietly and comfortably ever after. Aisha and Roz, what do you think? Does this mean that crime does pay?
I feel like crime shouldn't pay, but I think sometimes crime does pay, let's be honest. I think crime pays while you can get away with it. If you cannot get caught, it probably does pay.
Is it okay for crime to pay if you're put into an unfortunate situation in life?
I think if you have had very, very difficult circumstances, then that can and should be a mitigating factor.
What do you think, Roz?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree. I think in most of the cases here, crime did not pay at all. The crime of these swindlers was largely born from difficult circumstance or tragedy or trauma, and they went on to continue to have trauma in their lives. Lyons dies in her home, estranged from her children. Madame Rachel, again, one of her daughters was shot in Paris. Another one committed suicide, and another one shoots herself in the back of a London cab. And Fanny Davies, yeah, she works hard to build a new life in Australia, but the husband she finds, he commits suicide, and she ends up working as a housekeeper in her final days in her 60s, which would not have been easy. So I guess I'm trying to say crime doesn't pay, so how do we get round this? I think we've got to look at society and think about how we create a society that minimises these harms to begin with.
That's a bit of a downer, Roz, but I, for one,
that's what you pay me for.
That's very gloomy, Roz. I have to admit that I, for one, have enjoyed spending time with Madame Rachel and Anne Mary Provis and Fanny Davis and Sophie Lyons, because our lady swindlers opted to live life on the edge of what was acceptable and decided by hook or by crook to build themselves a better life. And their crimes certainly weren't victimless, I get that, but I do admire their audacity, their fearlessness, and their spirit. A huge thank you to our guest detective Baroness Aisha Hazarika and our historical consultant Rosalind Crone. And this is the last episode in the series of Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley. I hope you've enjoyed listening and spending time with these women as much as I have. And don't forget, there are also 3 seasons of Lady Killers to enjoy on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. This episode of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Reham Musa, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series by searching for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.